For your message this morning, you may open your Bibles to Philippians chapter 2. I want to look at a couple of verses that are going to serve, I suppose, as a text, except I don't plan to expound directly on them. I want to use them as a backdrop for a meditation that I would like to take you on. What I want to do is share these verses, and then we're going to look at an Old Testament story that is a case study of these verses to help us understand how life works, for lack of better explanation. Philippians chapter 2, let's start with verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and disputing, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. I consider these verses to be sort of a classic formula about, well, I'll just call it a motto for life, a formula for life. He says in verse 12 that his beloved, the people he's writing to, this congregation at Philippi, he writes to them that they ought to continue to obey, not just when he's there, but when he's gone, but they should work out their salvation with fear and trembling. And then the next thing he says is that God is going to work in you both to will and of his good pleasure, and to do of his good pleasure. And so there's a classic question that can be wrestled with. So who's doing what and what's really going on? If I am working out and God is working in, what's really going on? Where does the responsibility lie? Do I go through life saying, well, God's going to work in me, his will and pleasure. I'll just watch for it to develop. But no, the scripture says to work it out yourselves with obedience and fear and trembling. And this can actually become huge to a young person as they're looking at life and they're getting to where they're responsible for their own life and they see life stretching out ahead of them and they know that they have to make some decisions. It's not going to just happen. It's not going to be all external, but there will be internal considerations and decisions that are made. And we talk about life as finding God's will for your life, almost like this working out is a discovery of God's working in. And I guess you can say it that way. Not long ago, the youth were at our place, and there was a young man. After a while, he says to me, he says, I have a question for you. He said, how do you know you're in the right church? And I said, oh, I don't know that that question ever gets answered. Everybody answers it differently. Everybody wrestles with it. Some don't. He said, well, how did you decide? Well, I said, I got married. I got a job. We had some children. And after a while, I stopped asking the question. Because I was so busy doing what had to be done today that it really wasn't worth a lot of time to be strategizing for where we're going with the future. Well, he said, that sounds boring. I said, I know, but it wasn't. I said, I've gone all over the world ever since. And I said, one of the things you're going to learn as you go through life is that if you just buckle down and do what you're told to do, you'll be amazed at the places you go. And it was time the conversation moved on. But this thing can be huge, and I've watched it. You know, when you stop and think about, I want to go back now to the story of Saul's anointing. And I want to show you how working out and working in works together, sort of like these two big wheels that are meshed together and they're feeding off of each other and they're giving input to each other. Go back to 1 Samuel 9. I read through this story a day or two after I had that conversation with the young man. With the young man, I told him that working out and working in is a synergistic effort of God and man working together. And I said, you see, I read this story, and you see it going on in this story where God wants to organize Israel. They have asked for a king, which wasn't a very righteous request. Matter of fact, Samuel felt like there was sin involved in it. But God says, we're going to go ahead, and we're going to give them their request, and gave them Saul. And I want you to know this morning, before we even start reading the story, that Saul should never be viewed as a punishment for Israel. Saul was actually a righteous man, and you'll see that as we read through the story. Saul began a kingship with the right components, the right values, the right practices, but he changed. And when he changed, the prophet who anointed him cried all night because he changed. Okay? Never forget. He ended up the way he did because he changed, not because he was there. He was some evil man that always was, and God selected him as a backhander to the children of Israel for their bad request. But in his mercy, he gave them Saul, and they would go on a journey together. 1 Samuel 9, now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Zochroth, and the son of Apheth, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and goodly, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. And the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with thee, and arise, and go seek the asses. And he passed through Mount Ephraim, and he passed through the land of Shalisha, but he found them not. And they passed through the land of Shalem, and they were not. And he passed through the land of the Benjamites, and they found them not. And when they were come into the land of Zuf, Saul said to his servant that was with him, come, let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses and take thought for us. And he, that would be the servant, said unto him, behold now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he saith shall come surely to pass. Now let us go thither. Peradventure he can show us our way that we should go. Then said Saul to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there is not a present to bring to the man of God. What have we? And the servant answered Saul again and said, behold, I have here at hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver. That will I give to the man of God to tell us our way. Before in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he spake, come, let us go to the seer, for he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer. Then said Saul to his servant, well said, come, let us go. So they went into the city where the man of God was. And as they went up to the hill to the city, they found young maidens going to draw out water, and said unto them, is the seer here? And they answered him and said, he is. Behold, he is before you. Make haste now, for he came today to the city. For there is a sacrifice of the people today in the high place. As soon as ye come into the city, you shall straightway find him before he go up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he come, because he doth bless the sacrifice, and afterwards they eat that be bidden. Now therefore get you up, for about this time you shall find him. And they went up into the city, and when they were come into the city, behold, Samuel came out against him for to go up to the high place. Now Saul, the Lord had told Samuel in his ear a day before Saul came, saying, tomorrow about this time I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin. Thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people Israel, that he may save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry has come unto me. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, behold the man of whom I spake thee of. This same shall reign over my people. Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me into this high place, for ye shall eat with me today and tomorrow, and I will let thee go, and I will tell thee all that is in thine heart. And as for thine asses that were lost 3 days ago, set not thy mind on them, for they are found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on thee and on all thy father's house? And Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of Benjamin? Wherefore then spakest thou so to me? And Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the parlor and made them sit with the chiefest place among them that were bidden, which was about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, bring the portion which I gave thee, of which I said unto thee, set it by thee. And the cook took up the shoulder and that which was set upon it, and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, behold, that which is left, set it before thee, and eat. For unto this time said I, that I kept for thee, for since I said I have invited the people. And Saul did eat with Samuel that day. And when they were come down from the high place into the city, Samuel communed with Saul upon the top of the house. And they rose early, and came it pass about the spring of the day that Samuel called to Saul to the top of the house, saying, Up, that I may send thee away. And Saul arose, and they went out, both of them, he and Samuel, abroad. And as they were going down to the end of the city, Samuel said to Saul, Bid thy servant pass on before us. And he passed on. But stand thou a little while, that I may show thee a word of the God. Then Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, Is it not because the Lord hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance? I'm going to just stop reading there. We could read some more. It's going to be the story of the going home for Saul and the setting before the people as the king. But I want to just stop and look at this story and help us to see how life works, in that a man is working out and God is working in. Maybe you want to title the message that when man works out and God works in. And we're not talking about going to the gym and working out, but we're actually talking about a life that is worked out step by step according to God's plan, and it's being directly influenced and directed by Jehovah himself in all his sovereignty. And it was just fascinating again to watch this story develop with those two forces, for lack of better description, two forces in place. And I think if we can see God at work and Saul living righteously, we can lay down our first impressions that Saul wasn't all that great of a king. He wasn't at the end. He was rotten by the measurement of every measurement that you can do to a man in his leadership by the time it was over. But in the beginning, he was a man of God. Of that, I have no doubt. One of the things that I was impressed with this story is that even though the nation of Israel was at a time when they needed help, they weren't all that close to God, the one who had gloriously brought them out of Egypt, and it seemed like he used to get so irritated, so angry at them for forgetting that. But they weren't that quality of a people at this time. But you know, there is many, many Bible stories that will help me to understand that it is not the quality of the people around me that set the bar for what I'm called to be. You can actually rise above the common man in your relationship with Jehovah, just like Saul, or Gideon, or King Josiah, or Isaiah, or Jeremiah. The Bible is full of these illustrations of people that were not particularly set by the climate of the nation for their spiritual life. And it's just another observation in this story. Here was a man that lived righteously even while the people were going astray, directly away from God. And I want us to see that as we look at this. Now, let's talk about these, I'll call them two big wheels because I don't know what else to call them, but these two great forces of God working in and man working out. And I think we need to start, as we look at this story, in the observation of God working in, because he himself is the greater, existence. I think it's Brother Edwin Eby that has said already in a message that there are two great forces in this world. The one is man's free will, and the other one is God's sovereignty. And of the two, sovereignty is greater, for it is that which makes room for self-will. And then you have it all arranged in your mind, you know, just how this works. You are free to decide whatever you want to, but that is a privilege that was given to you by the one who never changes. And you can spend all Sunday afternoon on that one, but it's true. So let's start with God working in this story and just watch it as it goes on, because one of the things that we're going to discover as we go along is that Saul had not dreamed of being the king of Israel all his life. As a matter of fact, it almost comes to him as a surprise, the way it's written here. And I would not be surprised. There are many, many people that God has called. Think of Moses, that is shocked to be the shepherd in the desert. Where is David when he is called? Well, he is first anointed. Well, he's pulled into a feast from out of the countryside back to the village, and there he is anointed. But again and again, you have people that are walking righteously, and God calls them to things that ways to walk in that they have not yet heretofore dreamed of. And one of the problems in life with our dreams, as fun as they are, and as tasty as they are to chew on, they can be a little bit dangerous to do the chewing because they are sometimes not only illogical, they are way beyond our reach. And I know that there's 1,000 voices in our society that's going to say that's good, but that's all right. They would have to say that because they don't factor in a sovereign God in what they say. And so all your self-help gurus are going to say, look for the power within you, pursue it with all your might, and if you chase it, you'll get it. And that's how the way looks to them, because they have already taken the scissors and snipped out the wheel of an almighty God who is working, and there ain't much you can do about his force. Let's just talk about how God works. In this story, we must reckon with the reality that God sets the stage. And I've never been to the theater while it was theatizing, but I've been to some empty ones, and they have this stage up front. And it's not, well, if you're there when nothing's happening, it might just be wood and by its architecture made in such a way that it transmits sound healthily out into the audience. But when you have a play, you're going to set the stage. And if you want to have a play that centers around the Good Samaritan, you'll put a pile of rocks on that stage, and you'll have a door where the donkey and the man riding on the donkey, and the pile of rocks is going to be, you're going to set that up so that robbers can hide behind it and they can knock him down off his donkey when he comes in. You set the stage. Do you know that when we talk about God working in us and us working out our own salvation with fear and trembling, we have got to be subservient, at least in our thinking, and then in our doing, of course, to the reality that God sets the stage. In creation, God made, and he made, well, let's look at this story. Do you know what one of the chief ingredients to the story of Saul being anointed? There's some donkeys in there. There's some donkeys in that story. Well, God made donkeys thousands of years before. He was going to use them wandering around the countryside to collect a king. But on the sixth day, he made burros, asses, donkeys. Little stubborn things. We think they're impacted by the fall, but their behavior. But he made them. And he was setting the stage for a day when he was going to call a king for Israel. Now, that is so huge and so pre-planned that I just said it, but I don't understand it. I don't know how that all works, but I know that it happened. Okay, we're talking about God setting the stage. But later, God would, among the people, God would call a man named Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. And the man would come and he would say, now you go look at the sand which is by the seashore. I'll give you a people like that in your offspring. Look at the stars. And he didn't have a telescope, so he could just count hundreds or thousands maybe. And there he could see them. And he was making a people. And in the middle of these people, they would desire a king, and he knew all that, but he's calling them out. And generation follows generation, and one day, there is out of the tribe of Benjamin, several generations down the family tree from Abraham, there was a Benjamin. And in the tribe of Benjamin, there was a Kish, and he had a son, and God gave him that son, and God made that son. Did you catch how tall Saul was? How many of you think that he was taller than me? Yes, unless the rest of the people were smaller than me. There's only one place in the world I've ever been, and that's in Bangladesh, where I feel tall. A lot of the men are right here, but I'm not head and shoulders above them. And I also know that the fact that even in Bangladesh, when I'm that much taller than Wahidjul, it is because I was made that way. My mom thought if we ate enough vitamins, we'd grow, and we did, but we were still short Whitmers. They couldn't finish the job. This is how we are made, and God set the stage for the first king to be head and shoulders above everybody else. We can't make our hair white or black, but God can make you 6 foot tall. And we need to understand it. We're talking about how life develops, and we've got to reckon with the truth that he sets the stage. And I want to tell you this. When it comes to reckoning with God setting the stage, I would just like to say that I have come to understand that the bigger I let God be and the more powerful I see him as, the easier it is to trust him. It's the people that feel, I don't know, which comes first, the distrust or the blindness that you can't see his hand? I think some stories have pointed either direction, but I know they're tightly connected. Well, not only does he make this stage where the play goes down or where it develops and comes out, but he also makes the appointments. In your stage, if you have the donkey with a man come in and the robbers are hiding behind, that would be the stage master would be arranging that meeting of hoodlums meet traveler. Well, here, the story is that Samuel, the seer or the prophet, meets the young man who's looking for his donkeys. He's looking for his burros. But how do they get together? I don't know if you've ever tickled your imagination, but just looking back at you that are married, how did you actually find your wife? How much of that was your meticulous outworking, and how much of that was a meeting you didn't see coming? I mean, even if you sat behind her in school, how'd you figure that out? Or you met her at Bible school. Or you went on a VS project and there she sat at the table. I don't know how you met. It doesn't even matter. But if you want to do something enjoyable, look back at your story. And this was so interesting. When my son got married, I told him that he can thank God that I became a bishop so he could find his wife, because that was the only way we got to where they were. But she better be thankful that her dad, her grandpa, tried to farm and flopped at it, even though he always dreamed of being a farmer. And the boys started a sawmill, which actually got off the ground, and they could live on that sawmill, because it said all these pieces were the arrangements meeting so that one day you went down to Fourth Avenue's Bible Discovery class and you're working with this young lady and you start seeing it. You know what? She pleases me. I'm going to go get her. Okay, that is just courtship and marriage. But look at where you live and ask yourself how you got there. And we have to be reasonable with the appointments. God makes the appointments. How did God bring Samuel and Saul together? Well, one day, some burros ran away. And I'm sure somebody was a little bit exasperated when their tails went over the hill. Because that's how it is when our animals get out. It's, why do we have to put up with this? Well, in the big scheme of things, God was calling a king when the donkeys ran over the hill. And I don't know if you can see that in your life, but it helps if you look for it. Because you'll cope better if nothing else. There's something in the lawnmower breaking down that's going to feed the rest of this week. And I don't know what it is, but it's there. At least if God works in my life. And maybe I don't even have to see it, but I'm just telling you. Okay, so these donkeys run away. And what's fascinating to me is that Saul and the servant leave, and they go looking for these donkeys. Now, you know that if you're, let's say that this is the farm right here, and your donkeys ran away, the first thing you would do as you're leaving is you'd say, okay, they went that away, and dumb things like to run downhill, I'll head for the lake, okay? You would actually start to deduce which way they went based on the pieces that you have. Well, which way did the donkeys actually go? I don't know, but the men thought they went toward Samuel. At least that's where they ended up. And that wasn't as random as it first seems. When you stop and think about it, even the donkeys running away probably had their fingers in Samuel and Saul getting together for the meal. And away they go, and they look and they look, and the beasts disappear. I don't know. I didn't know that horses were that smart. The ones I've been exposed to could have never hidden from me for 3 days. They just don't have that intellect. You see, beasts are more instinctive than intellectual, and the instinct is installed by God. And so whatever they did was God-directed. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but even when the animals get out, it's instinct-directed, not an intellect. Well, who would know that when the men get to the end of themselves and go looking for the seer, they would walk up to the village where Samuel had planned to have a sacrifice that day? They didn't know. You see, this is his hometown, but you've already, if you've been reading through 1 Samuel, you know he's hardly ever there. He's on the road all year long. And they actually didn't know he was going to be there when they decided to go see him. They said, let's go see if he's there. Maybe we can ask him. And they got there and they said, oh yeah, he's here. Matter of fact, he's going to have a sacrifice here at lunchtime. Get up and you'll meet him. And so they go trudging up through there and there they meet him. And how did that all happen? Well, he who sets the stage makes the appointments. But they talk. And here we go again. How was he supposed to know that he's the next king? Well, the day before, God spoke to Samuel and said, you're going to meet another king tomorrow. Is God working or is man working? Which way is this? Who is actually calling the next king in this story? Well, it's God, but he's working through Samuel. And after a while, the next day, they meet, and God speaks in Samuel's ear, there's the man. And so Samuel, the obedient prophet that he is, he follows through. And there at the beginning of chapter 10, he sent away the servant. They've had a night of rest, and now they're going out, and they're traveling home, and he anoints him to be king. And then, we're still talking about God making appointments and God setting the stage. Samuel looks at Saul, and he says, now, when you leave here, there's going to be three confirmations that what happened is real. And we can read down through. Verse 2, when thou art departed from me this day, thou shalt find two men by Rachel's sepulchre in the border of Benjamin, and they will say unto thee, the asses which thou wentest to seek are found, and lo, thy father has left the care of the asses and sorrowth for you, saying, what shall I do for my son? Now this is way before cell phones and GPSs and tracking hardware, but the divine appointment is that when the newly anointed king walks down the road, he gets to Rachel's tomb and there's two men coming the other way. And it's just, you see these little details being arranged, and what they say is that the asses are found and you should go home because your dad's worried about you, which is what Samuel said they would do. And the only reason he knew that is because God, who makes the appointments, told him that's what would happen. And so it all happened. And we're still talking about God working in our lives, and there's this emotional confirmation. God is here, he's at work, and we're on the right path. It's time to go home, the asses have been found. And then he traveled, so I said, you're going to travel on, and thou shalt go forward from thence, and thou shalt come to the plain of Tabor, and there thou shalt meet the three men going up to God at Bethel, one carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a bottle of wine. And they will salute thee and give thee two loaves of bread, which thou shalt receive of their hands. So they travel on, and they meet three men. And the first one is carrying three goats. I'm still checking with somebody that can carry three goats. I asked my boys, and they said, one's a handful, two, if you got long arms, three's impossible. I don't know if he tied their tails together. I don't know how he carried these three goats. But I know that he decided that morning, we got to take these goats to Bethel. And he loaded them up. And what he thought he was doing was taking goats to Bethel, but what he was actually doing is he was confirming the next king of Israel by carrying those goats up the road, and he comes to the crossroad with the king. Can you see how huge the hand of God is in the affairs of our lives and how he directs our way? And the other man is carrying three loaves of bread and he gives two of them to Saul. Now, you probably missed this detail, but I was looking for this kind of thing. The men were out of bread. The day, 2 days before, they wanted to give the gift to the prophet and they said, we can't, we don't have any food left. So they go over and find the prophet because they have a quarter shekel. They meet him. They get their word from the Lord. He gets anointed and he leaves. But I don't know what he would have bought bread with. Maybe Samuel gave him something, but I think they were breadless. Except that when they met the man, they got two loaves, one for each of them. And that would carry them on their journey. And now God is confirming the workings of his hand in a very physical way. Goats, bread, and wine. And you see that in this story, and we're looking at how life develops. And if you open your eyes, you can see it. Well, they keep on traveling. There's going to be a third confirmation yet, and that is in verse 5, when you come to the hill of God, where is the garrison of the Philistines, it shall come to pass, when thou art come to the city, thou shalt meet a company of prophets coming down from the high place with a psaltery, and with a tabret, and a pipe, and a harp before them, and they shall prophesy, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shalt be turned into another man. And what you have now is the spiritual enablement, the spiritual confirmation. He travels on, and God has made this divine appointment. Did they know that they were supposed to meet the king? Not that it says, but they did. And did they know they were supposed to have their musical instruments along to play their songs for when they met him? I don't know, but I don't think so. It just seems like they were doing what they thought they were supposed to do. And lo and behold, God made the appointment with Saul and the prophets. And in that time, he was turned into another man. And is there any doubt in this man's mind that he ought to be the king of Israel? He was still afraid, because when they tried to set him before the people, he ran and hid. But he would come forward as the story develops, and he would take his place in leading those people, and he would do it well for a period of time until some things changed in his heart. So what we see is that God sets the stage, and he makes the appointments, and there are confirmations. Now let's go back and let's look at Saul working out his own salvation with fear and trembling. See, that's the verses in the New Testament. And we're talking about now the human part of how a story works. Go back now to the beginning of chapter 9, verse 3. I am not going to be able to talk to you about Saul's dreams. I'm not going to be able to talk to you about his intelligence. I'm not going to be able to talk to you about his insights, because I can't find them in this story. But what the Bible does tell us about a man working out his way with God and life is profound, because it helps me to understand that when I told that young man that I got married and got children and got a job and got busy and I started doing what was important to do right now, I was closer to the truth than I thought I was at the moment. Because what the way it works out, well, let's just look at Saul, and then I'll explain how working it out works in conjunction with working in. It says in verse 3 that the asses were lost, and Kish, that's the father, says to his son, now this is the big boy. This is the man who is head and shoulders above his dad. He's bigger, he's taller, he's stronger, he's probably not richer, but because Kish was very powerful, he's very rich. It says, a mighty man of power, verse 1. But he's the kind of person, he has reached the stature in life where he's big enough to make his own decisions. And his dad comes to him and says, I need you to go look for donkeys. What'd he do? Ah, Dad, I was going to, we had a volleyball game tonight. No, they didn't have volleyball games. It says he went. And what it tells, a lid just comes off and you just see inside the man, is that he was a man that in spite of the things that were wonderful about him, he was still a man that operated under authority. He was about his father's business. Dad's donkeys are lost, I'll go look for Dad's donkeys. Now that's what the Bible says about Jesus too, and we look at it as a very wise and righteous thing. And truly it is, for he who is about his father's business will always be on the right path. Okay? But this which you can see about the man. They were somebody else's donkeys, they were somebody else's burros, but he invested at least 3 days of his life, and he was actually on the third day, he wasn't done. He just wasn't sure if it was still the right thing to do, because it seemed like they had looked for quite a while, and he began to wonder if they'd ever find him, and he thought about the possibility that they may have gone home. But he was a man that operated under his father's authority, and you see that. And one of the reasons why he was positioned himself to be the first king of Israel is not because of his intelligence, IQ, or intuitiveness. It was simply because of his submission. And that is kind of surprising because most gurus who want to tell you how to be your best in life and go for it are going to minimize the value of operating under authority. You don't hear a lot of, if you want to be successful in life, then do what you're told to do. But rather, it's, if you want to be successful in life, then do what you think you ought to do. And that is two different pathways. But this man, well, Samuel would look back on his life and say, back there where I anointed you, you were little in your own eyes, which means that he was full of humility. And I don't know exactly, I pondered over this, the fact that he was humble at this point, he could be told what to do and he would go. I suppose we can say that humility is the forerunner to submission. I know that humility and submission yield commitment and dedication. I mean, 3 days, I don't know what motels they stayed in at night. I don't know what steakhouses they got their supper in after walking all day. I'm suspicious that they just ate dry bread out of their sacks. There was some real commitment to find these horses, and off he went. And it was part of who Saul was, and it explains how he worked out what God was leading. Now go to 1 Samuel 9 and verse 6. I want to show you another quality of Saul's life. He says in verse 5, he is saying, we probably ought to go back home. And the servant says, we should go ask the seer. He's a man of God, and he can get, well, in verse 9, it says they would inquire of God by going to the seer. And so, yes, they went to see the man, but they were hoping to hear from God. And all I'm telling you is that there is this quality in life of Saul that when he got perplexed, bewildered, or stuck into the corner, he turned toward the voice of the Lord for the answers. I don't know how you found life, but that actually is something you have to deliberately choose. People do not by nature first choose, I wonder if I should pray about this. Now, it's a skill that Christians acquire, and there are some champions of the faith that have become prayer warriors, and the Bible exhorts it. But I do know that if you are going to work out your salvation, you are going to have to learn the pathway of when I'm stuck, I will go ask the seer. Now that's the Old Testament version of get down on your knees and start talking to God. Pray. And this was a quality of his life, that he was ready to turn to God. And I know that this is not our first tendency. We live in the Google age, and we'd rather turn to Google than God in our defaults. You see, one of the things I've learned is that Google is much faster than God, except for the times that God answers before we call. And that does happen. That is part of the spectrum of our lives. But in the normal ups and downs, when you realize, whoa, the Egyptians are in front of us and there's armies on both sides, there's mountains on both sides of us and there's an army behind us, what shall we do? And they cry unto the Lord. That's a deliberate choice. But our normal experience is that God betimes is slower than Google. And sometimes people are, I'll skip the adjective. They would rather go to Google than God because it's faster. And you get more options. Google answers in video. God answers often in text, where you read it in the Word and then you get your answer. And there ain't a single one of us that would rather have text than video. We like video. It appeals from the crown of our head to the tippies of our toes. But here was a man that says, I'll go see what God will tell. Google gives multiple possibilities. God's answers often seem very narrow. And this makes it tough. But I'm telling you, if you're going to be one who works out like Saul, you'll be the one who says, we have a problem. Let's go see what the Lord would tell us. And there's an answer in that of how you plot your life. If you can learn what Saul already knew and practiced, he came to the seer. And that set the stage for him to be anointed to the next king. Let me look at another quality that you will see coming out of Saul's life, and that is in verse 7. And that is that when Saul had a question, he was ready to pay for the answer. I have a question for you to think about this morning. Is truth free? It sets us free, but is truth free? What do you think? For Saul, it wasn't. Saul said, we can't go to the prophet unless we have something to give him. Our bread is spent. And the servant says, well, I'll tell you what, I've got a quarter of a shekel. And it gives the impression, although it does not say it succinctly, it gives the impression that that was all that was left. Now you have a picture that is closer to the widow and her two mites that is casting in the treasury. But this man wants to know the answer, and he's ready to pay for it, and he believes he ought to. And so he is scrounging through his backpack, his knapsack, for something to give the seer so that they can ask the question and get the answer. Solomon would write in Proverbs that when it comes to truth, we ought to buy it and sell it not, meaning that it is a commodity that bites into our wallet. There's a lot we could say about that, but I'm just intrigued by a man that wanted the answer. He was ready to pay for it, even though it was his last pence and the food was all. The quarter of a shekel would have been a lifesaver for the next bread. But in Saul's mind and the servant's mind, truth revealed was worth its last penny. And one of the problems that I have in my life as I'm trying to figure out where do I go from here is that we want an answer, I want an answer, and I really don't want to pay for it. And God is not a bank that you write up checks or swipe credit cards or PayPal or whatever. But there is a truth in that as we seek his face, it costs pretty much. And some of us find that it costs everything. Which is exactly what Jesus said it was going to cost. To follow me, take up your cross and follow me. To the young man, he said, sell everything you have. But this was a quality of his life. He was ready to pay for truth. He had that quarter shekel. But you ask yourself, how did he pay? Well, he traveled. They had to go up. It wasn't like he could dial a number, drop a coin into the payphone, and talk to Samuel. There were no cell phones, there were no pay phones, and so Saul walked right up to the village, to the man, and he asked his question. Except he never even asked his question. He was told the answer before he asked. I don't know if you caught that while I was reading, but he was told the answer before he asked. And that's the story of this man that pays for truth. But you know what? There are many opportunities, and especially I can see this when I was in my youth. There are so many crossroads where we're sacrificing and gaining truth. Something as simple as just going to Bible school for 3 weeks, where you stop the paycheck for 3 weeks and you write out $50, $100, and they lift some offerings, and you just come home a little bit poor. I guess if you had a rich dad, if your dad was Kish, he'd just write the check for you. Because he wanted you to have truth too. But you know, there's young people that will drop what they're doing and they'll go over there to Bangladesh and they'll write a check for a couple $1,000s so that they can go along with that. And that way the program has the funds to survive because the people giving in it are paying for their own way. And that's just one more way that you can buy truth, because those young people are then pressed into kingdom work on a level that they probably wouldn't have faced at home on many different levels of who they are, what shall we do, and where is God in all of this, and the doors open up. But it's not the only place. And actually, you will find that thread to be part of our lives where we are buying the truth the whole way through our story. And I think if you look, as you follow the Lord's leading, and where do you go? But you know, parents do this with the Christian Day School movement. 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, and some of them pay that per child. When you could just meet the bus at the end of the lane for free. It's public school. But there is a burden for somebody that says, I'm going to pay for truth instilled in my children. It's just another example. And the life is full of those. But so you have these three qualities I'm lifting out now of Saul's life, that he was under authority, he went to God for the answers of his life, and he was ready to pay to get the answer. And what I'm telling you is not so much how Saul made decisions, which is what we often think of when we say, what do I do next in my life? Where do I go? Where do I belong? And what shall I do? And how shall I decide? The truth is that if you follow the pattern of Saul, is you develop righteous characteristics in your life, and God will take care of the rest. He will set the stage. He will make the appointments. And when you get to be an old, old man, you'll say, wow, my life was closer to Abraham. I did go out not knowing whither I went, but I'm glad I went on the journey. And that's what it's like to follow God.